Hello and welcome to Channel Hoppers, the UK television podcast. I'm Mars Nestor and with me is Steve Doran.
Hello.
This week we'll be investigating Lucan on ITV, surviving the X Factor final and judging the Strictly semis. Elsewhere, we'll catch up on Soapland and witness television at its most heartbreaking in Don't Ever Wipe Tears Without Gloves on BBC 4. But first, this week's news. MasterChef The Professionals was won by Stephen Edwards after outshining his competitors on the final challenge, a three-course meal for the series judges. Now, can we just take a minute or so to talk about just how good MasterChef The Professionals is as a TV series?
Absolutely. I think an absolute classic in the reality television genre, so much so that nobody ever thinks to include it.
No, it doesn't feel like reality TV. It feels like watching really good food being made. And this, it's really well packaged. The challenges are really interesting and good. They vary up quite a lot. Different combinations of judges, different combinations of diners, different challenges, different locales. It's very good.
I think it's an excellent proof of why it is you don't always need a public vote. And I do honestly think that's part of the main reason it is so successful, because the judges just judge the good food. And they don't seem to be pandering to the sort of public sympathy. You don't have the ridiculous backstories. You don't have the bits to camera where you're urging the public to be on your side, because essentially the chefs don't care. Now, of course, having a public vote on what is essentially a taste test would make no sense, but that doesn't mean that there isn't somebody out there willing to pursue it. So I think possibly that's part of the reason I like this particular show more than I do any of the other...
Yeah. I can think of two cookery shows where they had public votes for food you had never tasted. One of which was the Great British Menu on ITV, which is terrible, and one of which was the first series of that nonsense Royal Menu show where different celebrity chefs...
The Great British Menu had a phone-in vote.
I swear it had a phone-in vote at some point. Maybe I'm getting that wrong. But the Royal Menu one definitely did, and it was ridiculous because it was just, here are three people talking about some food. Which one do you think was the best? No.
Yeah, it does absolutely make no sense. But I'm not at all surprised to see that somebody has tried it. But equally, it does just go to show you, perhaps, that, you know, even singing and dancing, maybe you just shouldn't get the public involved.
And we should take a moment to talk about the judges, because they're really good. First of all, Monica Galletti, who is basically the kind of standout star of it, in that she starts off really harsh, and as the chefs get better, she gets nicer to them, which is what you're meant to do. And her face expressions are amazing, when particularly with the early rounds, when the chef goes, oh, I'm going to do this, and her face is like, no.
But for anybody listening to this over podcast, he's pulling an expression a lot like Monica Galletti.
So she's really good, and then Misha Roux Jr., is a lot better than he used to be. He's really good. He's like kindly grandfather of cooking. He's like, oh, you've done really well. I'm really proud of you.
Single-handedly bringing the word unctuous back into British use.
He doesn't use it as much as he used to. I've been disappointing lack of unctuousness this series.
I still haven't worked out what it means. I need more context.
No, me neither. And Greg Wallace has been reduced to eating food, which is all that he is good for. And I liked this challenge, which just had him as the diner, Greg Wallace. It was hilarious. Outside of that, what I thought was really good about this series, and one thing that I was wondering because it was interesting, when they went to met the celebrity chef in Italy, Adam, who's one of the main contestants, didn't like it. Didn't like his food, didn't like the way around the kitchen, didn't understand it, didn't get it.
And he clearly thought he was a bit mad.
And it was really good TV to have this guy going, well, I don't know anything, I'm just a guy, from Scotland, but this is nonsense. You know, it was fantastic TV.
Jesus, reality television gets real.
Yeah, so that's MasterChef, it's over now. Elsewhere, in award news, Jack Whitehall was crowned King of Comedy, whatever that means, at the British Comedy Awards, and in light with no dominant figure. The awards are very evenly shared. Steve Coogan and Will Ferrell took home Outstanding Achievement Awards in domestic and international varieties. So, some thoughts occurred to me while I was attempting to watch this. Number one, giving an award to Will Ferrell because he happens to be in the UK and is promoting a film cheapens the whole event really quite remarkably for an award show. It was crawling.
Especially because you could probably make a reasonable case that Will Ferrell did deserve an international award, but it has been so tainted by the massive lead-up to Anchorman 2 that, it, like you say, it cheapens the award completely, even though you could make an argument for it.
Elsewhere, it is, as always in British Comedy Awards, a night dominated by bitchiness and point scoring, which is just not fun to watch. It's really quite distasteful, and particularly for a TV sector that's in a fair bit of crisis at the moment. British comedy is not great at the moment. And you kind of look at these people taking pot shots that are years old at each other and think, this is probably why.
The trouble is, you don't get people going to the Grammys and feeling like they need to belt out a number, and no one accepts their awards at the Oscars by doing a little monologue. Comedians, for some strange reason, never think they're off the clock.
It's very...
I'm at the Comedy Awards, I better be funny. Why?
It's very true. And the worst bit of all is always Jonathan Ross's intro, which is like, biting, and this guy isn't funny, and this guy isn't funny. It's like, you're Jonathan Ross. When was the last time you were funny?
Again, and it's this same thing. It's the sort of, I have to be getting a laugh at somebody else's expense because it's the easiest way to get a laugh. And I always want to say, it really isn't mandatory.
And finally, for me, a huge, huge, huge shout out to Nina Conti for winning Best Female Television Comic, which she was clearly completely shocked by. Basically, she made a documentary last year called Her Master's Voice, which was not what she was nominated for, but everyone knows her for it, which is just a phenomenal piece of work. One of the most interesting, funny, out there, like, elements of work I've ever seen. It's brilliant. Properly, properly brilliant.
I will add it to my ever-increasing to-watch list.
So I want to move on now to our feature review of the week, which is Lucan on ITV. So it's a dramatisation on ITV1 of the mystery surrounding Lord Lucan's disappearance, and what's quite interesting about it particularly is about the social circle that he was part of, and really how that doesn't exist anymore, and how his disappearance was almost kind of the last, kind of the ending of that particular group of people. And I was discussing when we were watching it that you can probably draw a line from the Profumo scandal to Lady Chatterley's lover trial to Lord Lucan, where the upper class of England just disappeared from public consciousness as the kind of moral arbiters or anything like that. It became increasingly clear that they were so disconnected from real life. And I think this show is really good at bringing that out.
I think it's quite telling, because I only ever had a sort of vague understanding of what happened in, you know, the Lord Lucan scandal. And in my head, without really knowing what date it was, I presumed it was sometime in the 40s and the 50s. Mm. Because the whole thing seems so ridiculous in the era that it actually happened. And I think that's a big part of it. There's a wonderful scene in the documentary where Lord Lucan turns to a friend to discuss why it is he should get custody of his children. And says, yes, but I'm an earl. And the absolute shock of listening to that as the audience is probably mirrored by how people were beginning to feel in society. And the absolute ignorance of that fact is so perfectly played, so subtly played. It's one of the best bits about the drama, I think.
Mm. Yeah, we should clarify, it is a drama as opposed to documentary. And it does state at the start that some of the elements of it are speculation. But we can talk about the show as it was presented. And in the show, Lucan ends up murdering the nanny very clearly. And obviously in real life, I don't know if that's ever been proven. I can't really speak to that.
I don't think that it ever has. And certainly, of course, it's never been proven as to why. The theory was always that he killed the nanny because he was trying to kill his wife. But obviously there's only one person that knows that, and we don't know where he is. But that's very much the view that the drama has taken.
Yeah. And the way that the drama is structured is it's framed as an author in the modern day investigating the Claremont Club, which we'll get onto in a second, and Lucan in particular. Based on that investigation, he wrote a book called The Gamblers, which is the book on which the drama itself is based. Now, what he's writing about, or what he started investigating, was the Claremont Club itself, which is a casino run by John Aspinall, or Aspers, as he's referred to almost throughout the drama, who ran a casino where basically all the rich friends he knew, all the lords and earls, came to gamble away their inheritances, and he made his fortune off this. And Christopher Eccleston plays Aspers in probably one of the most darkly cynical performances you'll see. I've seen some people questioning his accent. I think it's quite good.
Oh, I thought his accent was very good, I have to say.
He plays a very, very good, very upper-class villain who just... He's upper-class, he's always been upper-class. He thinks it's his natural right to rule and his natural right to be top of the tree. And that's what he keeps on pushing home to Lucan and to others throughout the drama, is that he is king, and they have to be king if they want... They have to rule like he does if they want to get ahead. And there's a scene at one point where he breaks up with his wife for cheating on her. And it's the most brutal scene I've seen, because there's no hint of emotions, no hint of care or anything. It's just I found out you're cheating, you're done.
See, I think it's funny you mentioned that a few people have taken the mick out of his accent, because I think it's quite telling insofar as, yes, his accent was ridiculous, but only in the way that certain upper-class accents genuinely are. And I think there is a similar theme to the entire drama, which is elements of it seem ludicrous, but that doesn't mean they aren't accurately portrayed, because ultimately what we're looking at is a fairly ludicrous section of society, as and when it was.
Yeah.
Perhaps it made sense in sort of the turn of the century, but in 1974 it did begin to look completely out of place. And that's what I think, again, the drama does really well, is that genuinely unsettling feeling like you're actually watching this way of life come to an end.
I think one way to describe Eccleston's performance is Eccleston playing the upper classes how he thinks the upper classes are. You know, given the way his other performances have generally gone, I think that's very true. But outside of him, there's Rory Kinnear, who's one of my favourite actors, as Lucan himself, who is compelling in his complete inability to contemplate or understand his place in the world or understand what is going on. And his what he does really well is his constant answer that I have to go to the casino, to the club, as he calls it. It's my job to sit at the table and gamble. And that's it. It's his job. It's his role in life. And he plays it very well, because he doesn't make Lucan a figure of fun. He doesn't make Lucan seem ridiculous. He just says these ridiculous things with the earnestness of a man who completely believes them.
And it's a very good job he does in... He plays the most unlikable character without going out of his way to play an unlikable character. There is a distinct way of playing the villain, the moustache twiddling... looking at the camera, sort of. But this is a character who, you know, absolutely believes in what he is doing and sees absolutely no problem with his view of the world. And you get the impression that the actor is not trying to make us dislike him. And that's what makes it feel so organic when actually you do.
Yeah, it's such good, because it's so underplayed and so subtle and so well done. And you can just imagine 100 actors doing such a worse job with that role. I think the murder scene that comes at the end of the first episode, we're recording this before the second episode is broadcast, which is tomorrow night from the recording date, Wednesday
for
night,
us.
For us. The murder scene in particular, he plays it really well, because he does it almost with... It's clinical, but... It's still with this kind of sense of entitlement, almost, in the way he does it. And there's no care, and it's all so brief and sudden. And I don't know how you play a murderer like that, but he does it incredibly well.
It's not at all a glamorised murder scene. It's not dramatised in any way.
Mm.
It's not even really highlighted as the big moment of drama. You could almost not see it coming, especially if you didn't know what had already happened.
Exactly, yeah.
And you sort of get the impression that that's how Lucan sort of feels about the whole situation, about his life. That he's somewhere... He remembers being there, he definitely decided to be here, but he's still not quite sure how he ended up here.
Well, there's that great scene with him and Aspers, where they're talking after, and it's after he's lost the court case and lost his children. And he just goes to Aspers, well, what if my wife was to disappear? And Aspinall's reaction is just, well, it would be a gamble. And that's just the way they viewed it. You'd be killing somebody. It's almost like, well, she is a problem. If you have to get rid of her that way, that's a way you can resolve it.
It was more there was no concern whatsoever for the other human being. The concern was only ever, how is this going to come back to us?
And we should mention Catherine McCormack as Veronica Lucan, because she humanises a person who is not particularly cared for in the story, in terms of how it's familiarly remembered. The story, in terms of how it's told, is always about Lucan, but this drama makes it very much that to her be a real victim of it, and to be a victim of this society and these people.
Absolutely. And I think it has to be mentioned, when she is having what I'm going to call a breakdown, even though it isn't, there is a point in the film where she's clearly under a lot of stress. She's clearly not knowing how she's going to move forward, but she absolutely is not mentally ill.
Yeah.
And even though Lucan keeps trying to get us committed and keeps putting her in scenarios that we would associate with mental illness, at no point does that performance become hysterical. She doesn't start impersonating mental illness. She sticks with what that woman was probably going through at the time, and she makes that very real and very, very relatable. I think you feel so sorry for her.
I think there's a... There's a fantastic moment that portrays their relationship so well when Lucan says, oh, we should go for a drive in the countryside. And they drive off, and it's played as just driving through the countryside, man and wife, and it's all very nice and pleasant. It's all rolling hills. And they get to a big house in the country, and it turns out that it's an insane asylum. And it's just a wonderfully played moment of her realising just how dangerous this man is and how much contempt he holds her in. It's really well done, and she plays it brilliantly.
And I will put in a little note about the woman playing Sandra, the nanny, or really I suppose the note goes more to the writers in that she's actually on screen for a very short amount of time. She's not in any way a central character to the drama that's unfolding. But in that very short space of time, you get a real feel for her character and what she meant to Mrs. Lucan and what she meant to that family. And you mourn her death.
Yes.
Which is difficult to do with a secondary character that gets introduced so close to the end of a drama. So that should be noted, really.
I mean, I just want to touch on this briefly, because I think there's no question that this drama handles it sensitively and is interesting and has a reason for existing. But I have seen it questioned about whether it's right to make a drama about a murder, particularly one relatively recently.
Well, this is the thing. Is it right to make a drama about a murder? Yes. Or else we have to start discounting a hell of a lot of drama. That is pretty much the number one thing we make dramas about.
But I mean a real life... But the third question is a real life murder.
And again, but we do that all the time. I'm not being funny. A couple of weeks ago, you and I were discussing a drama we saw about the murder of Casey Anthony.
Yeah.
And that's something that we as a species are fascinated by. That's a fact.
And I think, the other reason why I disagree with that point from when I read it is because I think this drama has an awful lot to say outside of that. But that murder is central to how these people, how these lords and ladies and countesses, how they viewed people outside their circle and how they viewed people of the lower class. I think that murder really is central to that whole society and how it came crumbling down.
Absolutely, and it's a murder that's viewed very much in context.
Yes.
And it goes a long way, really, to explaining the potential motivations behind that murder and the ramifications of it, which is as sensitively as you can handle a real-life murder story.
Yeah. So Lucan's, I think, it's very good TV. I think it's really well made by ITV. I can't wait for the next part, which I'm going to watch tomorrow night. And you probably have already watched by the time you listen to this, but hopefully...
Is it any good?
But moving on from the death of society, of a certain culture society, on to Strictly Come Dancing.
It's not really moving on, per se, but we'll go with it.
So, like we did last week with X Factor... Strictly's now at the semi-final stage. We want to talk more about the series. But first of all, the episode itself, Patrick went, so it's an all-female final. Did you think that was the right decision?
See, I want to say no, but then I start to think, who is it I would send home in his stead? I think maybe Natalie has plateaued a bit in the last few weeks, but I think the plateau she's on is probably better than the standard that Patrick reached, even though he has shown that. That continual improvement that is apparently so important. I just think at the end of the day, it's going to be a dance competition, at least in my mind. I know people always have their favourites and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. But I can't think of who I would have sent home instead, to be entirely honest with you. Maybe Susanna?
Yeah, I think if you go in pure quality, you send home Susanna. But I don't think it's about pure quality. It's something about engaging the audience. And her and Kevin... when they do a good dance, really get everyone involved and they really want to watch them.
Don't get me wrong, when I say it's a dance competition, I'm well aware that there's a lot of elements that go into dance. Yeah. I find it bizarre when people vote for somebody who's a rubbish dancer but he makes good jokes in the interim.
Yeah, it's not Mark in the final. It is, is Susanna, who has done several very, very good dances, if she's done more bad ones than probably the other ones and the other people in the final.
And as you say, there are other elements to performing a good dance, like that connection with your partner, with the audience, with the music, which is something a lot of them, I think, overlook.
Yeah.
A lot of them seem to have not listened to the lyrics that they're dancing to.
No.
Completely the wrong facial expressions. I'm a lyric person.
I thought in terms of that this week, Sophie's dance I thought was pretty poor in terms of relation to the music.
Sometimes I do think that, they look for something that's popular and has the right number of beats, but there have been some very bizarre music choices over the course of this series. The Argentine tango, to me, has to have a bit of Olé about it. Even if you can technically do the steps to a Lady Gaga number, that's just not the flavour of the dance.
Yeah. I just want to talk particularly about Natalie for a bit, because she ended up in the bottom two this week, despite the fact the judges gave her 40. And I want to talk about why that is, because They picked up on Len's lens as well. When Craig was, they asked Craig, well, why'd you give her a 10? And he goes, well, look at these turns. She's spotting every turn. And it's like, great. That's a really good technical skill. I can see exactly what you're talking about there. I didn't see that when she was dancing. What I did see when they were dancing was my phone, the ceiling, the kitchen. I find her so boring. Her dancing, I think it comes partly from the choreography, and I think her choreography recently has been really bad from the male celebrity, from the male dancers that's with her. I think it partly comes from her, and she seems so keen on the technical elements of it and so keen to be a good dancer that she forgets that it is an entertainment show. And she's not entertaining to me. She's just not... I never feel drawn to watch her dance. When she's the best dancer in the competition by most of the measures you want to use.
I don't know. I think sometimes she suffers from the sort of the cult of personality thing, which is to say she's not had a journey. She's not got a particular role she plays backstage. She's not the joker. She's not the cad. She's not the... And I think a lot of that is what we look for when we connect with people. I don't necessarily know that that's what you've done, but I think people like to see a story played out. They like to... They will give people points for what they perceive to be a good week for them, even if it doesn't pan out that way. And I think a lot of Natalie's issue is to do with whether or not she's connecting off of the dance floor. Which is not to say she's coming across badly, she's not. She seems like a very nice girl. But that's not a thing. She needs to be a thing.
Yeah. Elsewhere, I just want to talk quickly about the VT this week on Strictly, because it wound me up so much during the show. Every single couple were shown a series of messages about from their fans. Every couple included an elderly relative, some kids, some people on the... And it was like, oh!
Yeah, but the Strictly VT is always the same, because you can't do the emotional backstory bit, because they're celebrities, they're not members of the public, we know their backstory. For the most part, it isn't the... You know, we've not picked somebody with a particularly good story out of a pool of 10,000, we've got the 12 we could negotiate with. So as a result... The VTs do all tend to be shots of training, slightly manufactured looking laughing fit, someone falling over, something's doing something silly with a costume. It's the same montage every time. I think they should just scrap that bit.
I hate the VT so much. Anyway, I want to talk about that series as a whole, which means we won't get to talk about Dynamo because we've run out of time on that, which is a real shame because it was terrible.
Actually, we did talk about Dynamo, but he came by and he vanished it.
That was terrible. That was genuinely terrible. So the series as a whole, I don't think it's had the same entertainment value as other series. I think part of the reason is that because the dancers haven't been great. I don't think any of the dancers have shone. I don't think they're pushing each other to go better and better either. I think there was a group at the bottom and there was a group at the top, and after a certain period the elimination just became the group in the bottom getting eliminated one by one by one, and the group at the top just stagnating because they weren't really in danger, because there were four or five dancers before them to go.
They hoped.
And they didn't really push on. And it's like, there were just a couple of early Natalie dancers where you thought, this is going to be brilliant. And then she plateaued, and everybody else plateaued after her. And I feel the second half of this series has been frustrating to watch.
You can always tell when you start thinking about your highlights of a series and they all surround the judges. Every single laugh I've had has involved either Craig falling off his chair, or was it Bruno? I can't remember.
It was Bruno when it was Bruno.
Incidentally, Len this week explaining how in a passo you have to flick the cape. You can't just stand there like, would you like a vol-au-vent?
Oh, that was brilliant.
That was such a fantastic line. But the judges really shouldn't be stealing the lines. This is what always made Strictly better than The X Factor. The fact that it was much more about the contestants.
Mm.
And this year it's gone a bit soapy for me.
Yeah.
It's a lot more about the interaction between judges. They're getting all the good lines.
Part of that is that Brendan has stayed longer in the competition. He's a mouthy guy, so...
Absolutely. And part of it, as you say, is there's a want of drama from elsewhere. I don't think that they're pushing the drama down. I think they're rising to fill the gaps.
Now, talking about entertainment value, it's not a nice subject, it's a bit sensitive, but we do need to talk about Bruce.
Now remind me, is he that gentleman that was very briefly on Strictly Come Dancing at the beginning of the series?
Yes, the one who occasionally turns up and takes 4 hours to say a line. I just find myself looking forward so much to the weeks when he is not there and enjoying the result show so much more. It's quite difficult to say. Because he's not there.
Well, is it because he's not there? Or is it because Claudia is there?
No, it's because Claudia's there, and Claudia Winkleman is brilliant at this stuff. She's ab- absolutely brilliant. Why she's not there in place of Tess, I don't know. Why she's not there in place of Brucey, I don't know.
But I would like to see a primetime Saturday television show presented by two women while we're on the topic again.
Yeah. And if you have to have that male-female, that male-female combination, if they have to have that, there's any number in the world better than Bruce. And Claudia Winkleman is just better than Tess Daly. She's better. She's just a brilliant presenter. She's funny, she's quick-witted, and she's really gets into the spirit of it. She gets it, and I just don't think the other
and she can read an auto cue. I know, such a stunning and rare quality to find.
Yeah, you really shouldn't be saying, oh, the backing presenter's better because she can read the auto cue, but we're at that level now.
But yeah, but not only can she read the auto cue, but she does it so well that you forget she is reading an auto cue, which originally, if you go back to the 50s when it was invented, was the point.
That's strictly this year. I think they have to make changes for next series, to me. Just not presenting front, but they won't.
I don't think it will matter if they have the right selection of contestants.
Yeah, this is true. That we're focusing on that because of the lack of entertainment elsewhere, probably. Mm. Do you want to make a quick prediction for the winner?
Abby, for no real reason, though. Basically, because to my mind, in terms of dancing, it's between Abby and Natalie, and I don't think Natalie's got the votes to pull it off.
I have a sneaking suspicion Susanna might win just through sheer strength of public voting.
Quite possibly. This is the thing. It's one of those series you just can't call. Unlike the other reality TV series we're going to discuss, where the winner was obvious from week one.
Yeah. So after the break, we're going to talk about the X Factor final. So, X Factor, and welcome back, by the way. The X Factor final was, best way to describe it, bit of a drag?
Bit dull, I have to say.
I never realised how much I'd miss Rough Copy, but by God, he needed somebody with some energy.
I think so, and I think also, the trouble with having an outright winner in the way that we undoubtedly did in this season.
Oh, when there was the pause, when it's who's going to win, Nicholas or Sam? Sam's going to win. Sam's going to win. Sam's winning. Why holding this pause? Sam's winning.
And I think even in other seasons, I mean, even when Matt Cardle won, who we now know had the highest share of the votes every single week.
He was amazing. Yeah,
but we didn't have that public perception at the time.
No. That's very true.
You know, that we realised afterwards. And of course, yeah, he was a bit of a favourite, but we were all still a bit nervous about who was going to win. James Arthur.
Yeah.
Really, nobody knew if he was going to beat Jermaine or not. I think this is the first time that I don't know if maybe it would have been true in the Matt Cardle era if it had gone off the boil then, but for this year only, I felt absolutely no tension whatsoever in the final.
No, none whatsoever. And like we said last week when we were predicting a top three and you went Luke, Nicholas, Sam, I was like, oh, you just can't pick in any other order. It was just that, you know, that was it.
It was quite funny watching Luke's face when they told him he was being voted off and he was like, yeah, no. Yeah. You might as well have been saying, Luke, your bus is here.
Yeah.
And
okay.
off he went with his guitar to get on his bus. He knew.
He knew. But the thing is, Sam is definitely a worthy winner.
Hmm.
But I think she won by so far because it was a relatively weak series.
Oh, see, now this I disagree with. I think it was a weak series insofar as the judges, the production, all of that stuff. But in terms of contestants, that's what's really sad about it. This should have been a really strong series.
You think?
Yeah, well, look at... Okay, Luke, really unusual. A lot of things could have been done with Luke. The fact that he made it to the final, not somebody we normally see. Nicholas, really strong voice, normally the runaway winner. Sam Bailey, really strong voice. Tamira Foster, really amazing singer. Great backstory, looks amazing. When have we ever had a year with that strong competition? Normally you've got the three that are fighting it out.
I have a slightly different view of the series in that I just think there was... Okay, there were some people who started off well, but only Sam kicked on. And outside of her, I thought it was really weak. And I think, okay, now's a good time for me to talk about the problem X Factor or the X Factor producers have, which is, what are they going to do with Nicholas now? Because I just have in my head a vision. Did you ever see Stephen Gately's solo single video?
I did. I also saw the video he did for charity with the Kumars at number 42.
Well, okay.
That was worse.
The solo single video, if you haven't seen it, is just Stephen Gately striking that arms wide pose, the kind of flying pose.
For those of you listening via podcast, Miles is doing the arms wide flying pose.
You know what I mean. It's going to be the same. Nicholas just doing that for about 3 minutes because it's the only way he knows to add anything to any note he sings. I just think I am stunned that someone who's come through the X Factor, who's done all that, which is about live shows, can still be that bad at performing by the end of the series.
However, this said, he has still really only had, 12 weeks worth of experience of singing in public.
Yeah, okay.
Ordinarily, when someone hits the big time, they've done 2 or 3 years in clubs, in slightly bigger clubs, blah, blah, blah. For me, if it was me in charge of Nicholas's career, I wouldn't do anything with him at all for the next 3 to 4 years. I'd do independent shows, do clubs, get a bit of experience on the road, try and build him an image as an adult. Mm. Because any cute little he's only 17 year old image is basically shooting yourself in the foot, because in 2 years' time he'll be fighting against it.
Yeah.
And I think some things just come with maturity. I wouldn't do anything with Nicholas until he's older, personally.
Well, we'll just have to agree to disagree with our expectations of Nicholas's future career. Can we just take 30 seconds for me to complain about the Sam and Nicole duet?
Okay, only if I get 30 seconds as well.
Okay. First of all, the song. I hate that song.
I love that song!
I hate any song which is just a plain piece of paper for people to warble over to show, like, how long they can hold a note. How long they can hold a note and how much they can moderate their voice. Because if that's what singing is, why don't they just sing 1 3-minute note and then we can all applaud? Singing and songs are about more than that. I'm just singing the same line over and over again with increasingly ridiculous.
What are the words, Miles? What is that song about? Everything I was going to say about Sam and Nicole has gone out of the window.
Okay.
I'm going to justify this song.
You will have time in a minute.
I so won't, and you know it.
Elsewhere, Sam and Nicole singing. So I didn't like the song. I didn't like the performance because it was all that kind of nonsense over singing, which I don't like, and it's not real. Secondly, Nicole, you're a judge. Sam is the one trying to win X Factor. Not you. Producers, cameramen. Nicole is a judge. Sam is the one trying to win X Factor. Therefore, you shouldn't have the cameras on Nicole for 80% of the time of that performance. And Nicole, you shouldn't take all the big notes, particularly the last note, which, judging from myself watching it, it looked an awful lot like you took from Sam when Sam thought she was going to sing it. Because Nicole goes, love me. Sam goes, love me. Nicole looks at Sam. Sam goes, love me. And Nicole goes, love me. And this ridiculous, about 90 minute long
note.
You've
had way longer than 30 seconds. And I'm going to insist on the same amount of time.
You can have 30 seconds.
Typical. Bloody typical. Well, in that case, I will simply say, producers, regardless of who you film and who gets most amount of mic time, it really shouldn't be Jedward or whoever it was backstage talking all over it. This is the number one show on British television, and I'm not being funny. Me and you ain't made that mistake. So that, especially since they did it to her last year, Nicole must be getting a complex.
I think she, yeah, probably, because the producers go, oh, she's doing it again, cut her mic.
Click over to Jedward. And secondly, to just say that I Am Telling You is a phenomenal song about an incredible moment of heartbreak, and that Jennifer Hudson does an incredible job of showing when emotion is just ripped from the very bottom of your lungs.
Okay.
You have no soul.
I may not have a soul, but I don't like that song. So.
The two things are related.
It could be all changed next year in X Factor, which we just mentioned, in that Gary says he's leaving. I can't imagine Sharon Osbourne hanging around.
I don't know. She's had a good season this year. Yeah, she might stick around for another one.
She doesn't like doing it, though.
I don't know. She seemed like she was having a pretty good time.
And Louis has said he's gone, which he may not do. But he's said he's going.
Yeah, but he says that every year. That's part of the tradition.
So they may be all changed next year. Almost certainly be Simon Cowell back after the heroic failure of X Factor USA to gain an audience.
Don't mention the war.
No. Anyway, that's X Factor. And I think television does a number of things. One thing television should do is be silly and entertaining and over the top and fun, like X Factor. I always think TV should talk, should kind of hit you with good drama sometimes and keep you kind of mystery and suspense, and it's what Lucan does really well. I think that is entirely valid use of TV, and the TV can also be incredibly powerful in other ways, and that's why I really want to talk about Don't Ever Wipe Tears Without Gloves, which may have the worst title of any TV show this year, but is also is the viewing experience of having your chest, your heart ripped out of your chest and crushed in front of you. It is the most heartbreaking, the saddest, most powerful piece of drama I have seen in an awful long time. So, what is it? It's a Swedish drama broadcast on broadcast last year in Sweden and this year on BBC4. And it's about how HIV and AIDS, or the first hit of HIV and AIDS, affects the Stockholm gay community. And devastating is not the word. This was a group of people who had no idea what was hitting them. Absolutely no idea. If you've ever read the book and the band played on, I recommend you do if you haven't. It's about a similar subject in it. It's about a medical community that and a society that was so far behind the time that it just didn't get the warning out early enough. And by the time anyone realised there was a problem, the vast majority of that community were already infected and already dying, whether they knew it or not. And it's heartbreaking material. But what they've done is they've taken that material and they've formed it into these true life stories that are incredibly hard-hitting. And they take it and they take stories that are inherently sad, and they take imagery and a certain overwrought kind of visual metaphor, which you would call overwrought in any other circumstance, but because of the sadness of what's going on, it feels entirely appropriate. It feels entirely appropriate that one of the key callbacks in the series is a child's handprint on a window, as the father wipes up the handprint, because why did the child leave this handprint, and why did he press his hand against a mucky hand against a clean window? And the father wiping this away is a constant callback in the show, as that child suffers horrendously from HIV and dies. There's elements of that throughout the show, like a child's parents see a white elk and they say people hunt them because they're different, and you obviously get the exact meaning of what that sentence is about for this child who turns out later to be gay. But you know, in almost any other context you'd feel like that's too heavy-handed, that's too on the nose. In this one it just doesn't feel like it. It's incredibly moving. So I want to talk through some bits of it. There's three episodes. I've seen the first two. They're based on the trilogy of books. To give you a hint of where this is going, the first book is called The Love, the second called The Disease, and the third book is called The Death. So far I've seen The Love and The Disease, and I'm not quite sure I'll be able to see through the third part.
You don't know it's going to be a sad ending.
I'm pretty sure I do know.
I think with the exception of when you took me to see Titanic, this is probably about as sure as you're going to be.
Yeah. So there's a few bits that are really good. First of all, what they do really well is they present the whole culture of the gay community and how underground it is and how quiet and secretive they have to be and how ashamed they have to be, or society makes them be, even though they're not themselves. But society makes them be quiet about it, makes them join these little gangs and stuff and act around these few specific places where gay people can be in the city. And that does really well because it enforces it. It kind of gets this idea of how far we've come, that now gay people can be gay openly, which is just so obviously the right thing. And it shows how much this disease went through these people, because there's a really good scene where the mother is on the phone to her son saying, "I read about this AIDS virus. And she uses the phrase, "I know you've started this homo sex thing in Stockholm," which is a really good phrase to use to describe it. It's a parent trying to comprehend and not. And him yelling back, it's just people going against us because we're gay. It's just, that's all it is. They all hate us, and this is just the latest thing they're saying about us. And you see that, and that's kind of parallel with these newspaper front pages, which is clergymen saying AIDS was brought by God.
Mm. Which sadly is still an idea that prevails today, and it's worth mentioning that a lot of the issues that are brought up by this documentary, yes, it's true, we've come a very long way.
But
it's true, we've come a very long way, but nonetheless, I think that the saddest parts of any historical look at the gay movement is the bits where we haven't.
Yeah, and you know, when you see that headline, which is a real headline, you think, yeah, if I saw the headline that was about me, I think, yeah, AIDS is made up, or AIDS is against us, or, you know, this is something that's been forced on us. The other thing it does incredibly well in an incredibly heartbreaking way is because you know what's going on and the characters don't, and they use that really well. In the main character, I suppose you could argue main character Rasmus, is goes to Stockholm to finally have a chance to be gay, because he lives in this small like town in rural Sweden. So goes to Stockholm and he finds all these kind of gay, the kind of common pickup places, and he has sex with his first person he's had sex with, and they're having sex, and he feels on the back a lesion on the guy's back, and says, "What's that?" And the guy says, "Oh, I got a couple of them. I don't know what they are." And your heart just breaks in two, because you know instantly then what the fate of these characters are, and they have no idea. And that's what it was like for this community. They literally had no idea. And you're an episode and a half later in the drama before he realises what's happened.
I think it's also very important to remember that it's very easy now that we know all about HIV and AIDS to judge the reaction to AIDS at the time, and the fact that people wouldn't touch those they knew were suffering, wouldn't share glasses. It seems ridiculous now, but of course that information just wasn't available. And if it had transpired that's how the disease was carried, that would all seem perfectly reasonable.
Yeah, and that's what's really good about it as well, is that the unease of this community, and that when there are people with HIV and AIDS around, that there is a distinct unease about how they interact with people who are disease-free and people who have it. And that's really well played as well. And again, they won't share glasses, and it builds in so well. Just the last thing I want to talk about, because I could talk about every second of this show, it's so good, is where there's a Jehovah's Witness whose boyfriend turns out to have HIV. So he goes to his parents. First thing he does is he goes to his parents and says, "I'm gay." They turn up a couple of days later with cake and with flowers. And they're sitting there talking about his decision, about he won't change it. And then he realises and says, "Oh, that's where you have cake and flowers. This is my funeral." And the parents say, "Yes, we can't talk to you anymore. This is the last time we'll speak to you." And that's not about HIV. That's about being gay in the 80s, and that's about what it is like to be unable to be yourself, because you know that everything you know, every person you know, will reject you fundamentally because of that. And it's horrific and sad and well played and well acted, and the whole thing is, if you want to make heartbreaking TV, this is how you make it, because none of it feels exploitative. You never feel like this show is just twisting with your emotions. You feel it's presenting something real, and that what's real was just that sad. And it's so good TV. It's so, so good. One reason I want to talk about that is because TV can be important in every different way. And it can be important when it's X Factor being seen. It can be important when it's Don't Ever Wipe Tears Out of Gloves being so very good and being so very sad. Another way it can be very good is in soaps.
Which sometimes can be one thing and sometimes can be the other.
Yeah.
I find when it's done well, it can raise important issues. When it's done badly, it's hilarious, not always intentionally, which probably brings us on quite nicely to Coronation Street.
Yes, which does have that thing where on certain storylines it could be incredibly powerful and important drama for good, and other times can be, why is everyone in a lake?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Coronation Street, I maintain, is the best soap opera for sort of realism and so forth, but it's not in any way immune.
So, a couple of things I want to talk about this week from Coronation Street. First of all, Nick's new personality coming to the fore, particularly forcing Gail to choose him or David, which was... I don't know if it worked terribly, because I don't know if Nick's new personality works as an act. I don't think he's portraying it that well. But I do think that was a good way of enforcing that Nick is very different now. and that his attitude towards everything is incredibly different now. And to have him say you have to choose was a kind of moment you weren't ever expecting to happen, even though it was at the background of your mind.
Absolutely. I think the funny thing about this particular storyline is it's very hard to categorise it as either good or bad. Because some of the things it aims to do, I think, are very good things. The fact that you've got an entire close-knit family trying to deal with a loved one whose personality has changed. And that is something that does affect families across the country and is a very niche problem to have to deal with. And I think, maybe not so much on Nick's performance, but certainly Gail and Leanne, Kylie, the surrounding family, what do you do when you love this person and it's not their fault they've changed, but nonetheless the things they've changed about themselves stop them being the person that you loved?
Yeah.
How much loyalty do you owe someone to continue loving a personality that's changed? And I think that element is really good. On the flip side of that, you've got poor old David and Kylie trying to work out how one would realistically act in a scenario that would never realistically come up.
There's a thing that I have, or that a quote I use, which is from an episode of Angel, which I think was series 3 or series 4.
For those of you who don't remember, that was the spin-off to Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yes, that was with Angel the Vampire as the lead character.
Which is a good setup. It wasn't exactly Captain Realism
pants. It took a while to go over the cliff. But at one point, there's a demon that blacks out the sun, and it's one of the big series 9 storylines. At this point, the characters have to leave the building. One of the characters, a female character, looks up at the sky and says, "Oh my god, we lost the sun." There is no way to portray that emotion. If you're a writer and you write that as a line, you're condemning that actor to delivering a bad line. Because there's no physical way anybody could ever connect with that sensation. And that's what I mean about these kind of lines you get in this storyline, is that there's no way out there. They're "we're lost the sun" moments. They don't happen in real life. You can't portray them. It's impossible.
Yes, I, for example, have absolutely no idea how I would react if I found out that my partner was secretly responsible for the brain damage of another person, but only because he thought that I'd slept with his brother and we didn't know whose the baby was, but I certainly think I'd wait until the wedding day to discuss it.
So that's a bad breakup story. A really good breakup story is Julian Bryan over the adoption row and his job in Cardiff. I want to weather this particularly for the scene in the bistro where they finally have a chat without anyone else around and they explain their differences. And Julie just says, "I have a dream for the rest of my life and it's not in Cardiff." And the line from Julie after of saying, I've heard the other characters saying, "Did you get back together?" And saying, "I'm not that stupid. We found a way to break up." I thought was a really good, really real moment that soaps can do and Coronation Street does particularly well when it wants to. And I thought I just want to highlight that was really well done and it's been a good storyline, I think.
Absolutely, and I think credit to Coronation Street for not keeping Julie and Brian together because they're a popular couple. Because in reality, as much as their characters meshed quite well, that relationship wouldn't have worked when you wanted two different things. And I think it is nice from a viewer to watch scenarios that you've been through yourself.
Yeah. I think Coronation Street is heading towards an uptick in terms of quality. I think EastEnders, on the other hand, is heading very much into a downstreak.
Okay, you're not actually that much of an avid watcher of EastEnders. Just as a heads up, I'm not sure it's ever been better than this.
Oh dear.
Sometimes you know how current things can taint your memories, but I'm just giving you a little heads up there.
Okay. But EastEnders, and there's two things I want to talk about from EastEnders. Number one, can we talk about Dexter? He's had a kidney removed, has had no acting talent put in, unfortunately.
Well, here's the thing. I actually don't necessarily know that it's the actor's fault about Dexter. I think you and I have a slight disagreement about this. I think the actor is doing a good job of playing a bad character. I think that if you actually look at the problems with character, all of his mannerisms, all of his arguments, all of his outbursts, they're just very cliché.
Yeah, that's very true.
He has been told to act the archetypal London teenager. There's no depth to him whatsoever, but I'm not sure, really, there's a lot there for the actor to work with. I think he does do quite a good job of portraying that desperate emotion at losing his dad. He just isn't given any scenes or any lines in which to put it into.
Yeah.
That's the sad thing.
I felt sad this week when he was going to get in the cab with his mum when they were going to go to Newcastle for a new job. And I was like, yay, no Dexter. Oh, he stayed. But we disagree on that. Elsewhere in EastEnders, I don't want to talk about it, but we kind of have to talk about it. And it's going to become bigger next week, as I understand it. Janine, Michael, David. That whole nonsense. The nonsense with Michael being stabbed was terrible for a start. We've discussed it personally before, but that whole scene was terrible. That whole plot line is pretty poor. And the problem with that plot line is it's going to hang around because there's mysteries there and there are secrets left untold and it's a soap, so we've got to explore them. We can't just ignore it and move on.
This is the thing. In Coronation Street, I actually trust that Alice might just go to prison. I do actually trust that because... But, of course, in EastEnders, she'll have to get her comeuppance. And in EastEnders, there is absolute... Joey and Janine sleeping together.
Well, that happened for a couple of weeks, didn't it?
Yeah, but why? Why did that happen?
I just... That whole storyline just features no characters I find realistic in any way.
What an interesting... No characters I find likeable.
No, I don't either. I just... I hate that it's hanging over the soap. I'm just kind of waiting for it to be resolved so I can move on to something hopefully better, but probably worse.
Oh, let's just start watching Emmerdale.
Anyway, that's all we've got time for this week. So thanks very much for listening. Our Twitter handle, if you want to get in touch, is @ChannelHoppers. And our email account is channelhopperspodcast@gmail.com. Please do send in your comments on the show, send in things you want us to watch, things you thought about what we've watched. We're all always very appreciative of any feedback, any comments and any involvement. But thank you very much for watching. It's goodbye from me.
And Merry Christmas from me.
And we'll be back next week with more nonsense. Bye.
Bye.